So everything was going fine. I was making the payments. And of course, them days, the depression was on outside. You could land a carload of feed in here. Well, it was $12 a ton down in Seattle, and you can land a $30 freight, and it's $42. You can land a carload of feed. And of course, milk was only 2 bits. And but we was paying our bills and making expenses, and then there was 3 or 4 other areas here, like old Frank Burchard and a fellow by the name of Mitchell. And they come to me and asked me to buy them out, and I'd buy them all out. And the last one I met was Busby's dairy out here.
Oh, yeah.
He had quite a herd. He had 30 cattle.
30.
So I went to old man Bentley and asked him if he wouldn't take half of them. I said, I'm so filled up and so poor now buying cows. I said, I'll take half of them if you'll take half of them. And I said, we'll get them all out and it'll just be you and I. Nope, he couldn't do it. He had too much milk. He wasn't getting rid of all his milk. So it wound up by me taking all the cows. So they were just him and me and then, you know. So I'm glad I didn't buy him out or approach him, because when a customer gets sore and mad at me, they go to him. And when they get mad at him, they come back to me.
You had it between you.
Yeah. And so then he had a little bit of tough luck. He had one of the carbide plants, you know, light plants. And so I'd worked in the California saloon, and I seen one of them blow up there, burn it down. And so it was on an armistice day, on the 11th of November, and he started his boilers up. And I think he must have had a leak from this carbide, because that night the place blew up. And so then I was all alone here, and so I divided the milk between his customers and mine until we got in business again.
Where was his place located?
Right where he is now. Yeah, he used to be up on Garden or on Bentley's Island at first. Yeah. And then he went down there and took over this area. A man by the name of Young.
Young.
Was the first one to ever homestead that place. I'll never forget it, because he gave me a job of weeding carrots. That was the first summer I was here.
I've always been interested to know, when was the land cleared out there in front of your present dairy buildings? Can you remember when it was forest, or was it always cleared? Since
no, there was heavy timber out there in front when the first man to homestead there, his name was Mary.
Mary?
Yeah, there was right down next to the fairground. There was a couple of open spots there, and he used it for metals. And then Hickley was running a dairy up there by our home and grill, just where you go off the bridge. I should have brought the picture along tonight. I had a picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so Hickley bought Mary out in 1908. And then in 1910, he built these log barn down there and moved his stock and everything down there. Well, when I come there on the place, there's only about 20 acres cleared. And so every winter, there's some Finn boys, and they go out and cut wood of a winter, trim it off, and then I'd trim the, pull the stumps and everything and keep it clearing land. Up until, well, I used horses. I was running 8 head of horses there. And in the wintertime, of course, them days, they were logging, and then you put the horses out to in the logging camps. And of course, after that was over with, but then the boys I had, why, they didn't want to eat breakfast before they fed the horses. So I told the missus, I said, it's time to get a tractor.
What year was that?
Well, that was about 34 when I went into tractors.
34. Yeah. Now you skipped.
I had a last name, C Company. You worked for him, didn't you?
Well, I started in 37.
All right, and so I went up to NC Company and told them I needed a tractor and I needed a thrasher and I needed plows and I needed a disc, and I gave them what I needed, and so they gave me a price. So I was down there in the State Farm and I used some casement machinery. So the prices were pretty good, but the Seattle office wanted to add on 20% or so. And they were way ahead of the case people. So case people wrote back and says, we'll give you this so much and we'll give you the agency and knock 35% off. So that's why I got into the case machinery.
Oh, you were the case dealer.
Yeah, I was a case dealer here for years. But I never pushed it.
Yeah.
All I wanted was my own machinery. Let the NC company sell their John Deere.
That's a good way to get it.
Yeah. So after I got all the machinery, then I got rid of the horses. And a lot of that land was cleared with horses, and then I still got the old tractor yet on the 34.
Yeah?
Yeah, L, and it's the best tractor I got on the place.
Mm.
I've got a lot of tractors since then, but I can go out with the old double U after crank it, you know, which you always spits and goes off.
Good.
Yeah.
Now you skipped your railroad work. You worked on the railroad a while. Let's hear about that.
Well, after I come back out of the Army and come back in, and then they had a steam shovel, was putting all these cuts between here and Enana. So it was a big shovel, it was a Marion, two-man shovel. One guy had to sit out on the boom, and the other fellow run the shovel. That was a two-man shovel, and believe me, it was tricky because all the ground was frozen.
What did the man on the boom do?
He stuck the shovel into the dirt, and the other fellow, he'd lift it and swing it around and dump it. So I was on the, when I went to work for him, I was first as fireman, and then I got so at noon hours they let us monkey with the machines, so I got so I could run the boom. So then after this man had quit, well then his name was Pete Anderson, he was a shovel runner. And so I was up on the boom there, and it was really tricky because they bring in all this TNT in from the war and use it for blasting with these big chunks. And you had to be awful careful with the shovel or you'd tip her over. So we never tipped the shovel over though, so Pete had a girl here in Fairbanks that he had to come up here and see every so often. So they had a guy come up from Anchorage. His name was, I'll never forget his name, was Johnny DeWar. So he got on a shovel and he wasn't used to this frozen ground, and so I shoved the shovel down and then whoop, and over the shovel went.
Yeah.
Well, we finally got it back up and straightened up. And maybe I heard old Deacon Jones and old Dan Bannman. They were engineers on the ballast train, you know. And this old little number one, they got out here at the...
Tell us about it.
Huh? Well, when she come in here, there's a man by the name of Joslin. And lots of time the boats couldn't get up here, and the freight was all put off down here at the town of Chena. So he put that railroad in from Chena up to here.
Now, is this the railroad you're talking about building railroad grade for?
No. This was way back in the Tama Valley Railroad. So this man, Jawson, he built the road from Chena up to Fairbanks here.
You were first on the road from Fairbanks to Chattanooga?
Yeah.
Where you used the steam shovel?
Well, no, it was from here to Nenana.
But the road to Chattanooga was already built and in use?
Oh, yeah, that was built, yeah.
Before they started the road to Nenana?
To Nenana, yeah. And it was a narrow gauge road, and so I worked on all these cuts between here and Nenana.
It was narrow gauge to Nenana?
Yeah. Them days, yeah.
Little number one went to Nenana?
Yeah, number of this little engine, and they had another engine was number two, and then they had two bigger engines, which they was running out to Chattanooga, was 51 and 52. And so I worked on all these cuts between here and Nenana, and we got them all through. And then that winter, I went down to Nenana, and we built a plow driver for their bridges, and it was one of the plow drivers had a bridge that had to swing back and forth to drive the plows on a slant. But then the next spring, they need some ballast up here on the Chattanooga Road, so we went back up here at Fox, upon Fox, with the shovel, and while I was out there, the flu broke out again. And I got down so that there was nobody left. And so there's a man by the name of Abbott in charge. Frank Nash was out there at the same time.
Frank Nash?
You remember Frank Nash?
Yeah.
So they was going to leave us out there and take care of the camp, and so I got the flu. And I come on into Fairbanks, and so there was nobody left to run the trains, only Deacon Jones and old Bannerman. And there's another boy, he just died, was Jummer Johnson. He worked for the FE here for years. So we was running the train to Chattanooga. And so my brother-in-law got some cows in, and he's running the dairy out, so every night I'd come in, and they all had the flu, so I'd help them. And I'll never forget my sister-in-law. She had five bottles of home brew in the piano. So every night she'd come in, I'd have to hit the home brew bootleg.
That's more of that anti-flu medicine.
But it was good flu medicine. I never got the flu. As long as I had the flu, it was over, the booze was all gone. So after that, we got things to go on. And then we worked up for air for quite a while, and then we come back on down on the road here. And then that was in 1920.
20.
Yeah, so then that fall, from the missus told me, come outside, she wanted to get married or she wasn't going to wait for me any longer. Well, I beat it. So I took the train from here to Healy. And from Healy, I had to walk over to the Dead Horse, what they call Curry now. Mm-hmm. Well, gosh, we had to walk clear down that hurricane gut and up again.
There sits a lady that walked it, too.
Who's that? You did,
Sister
too?
Sister Gilbert.
Is that right? Well, you know what a walk that was. Well, say, it was, what was the girl's name was running the mess hall up there? Wasn't it Nellie Neal?
I don't know.
Nellie Neal from Kenai Lake?
Yeah.
Yeah?
So we had to walk clear over to Curry, Dead Horse. And then from there we got a train in, and I remember across that bridge, across the Shushitna or Shoshana River.
Shulitna.
And we had to walk across that to get on in.
Well, now this intrigues me, Charlie. Was this narrow gauge clear to Curry?
No.
It was broad gauge from Nenana on.
Yeah.
But that steel was brought up by the river and start running south.
Yeah, I went south, yeah.
So that was a standard gauge engine along there.
Yeah. No, that was all standard gauge.
So now you're on your way to Seattle to meet Miss Golden.
Yeah.
And you just crossed Hurricane Gulch. Carry on.
Well, we took the boat and went on down, and we got married in Seattle. It only cost me $10. Well, we went over there and we stayed on this chicken ranch and battled it out until the Depression come. And then I say, I come back here and put the cards on the table, and I've been here ever since.
Been here ever since.
And I planted myself. And everything was good up until this last war. On our two-bit milk, we could make money. But after that, everything went to depreciation.
I'd like
our
to.
Biggest trouble was, though, and I still think that we weren't ready for a state. Yeah. because the government was still pouring the money in here, and we didn't have the taxes, and everybody was paying their bills. And when the taxes come in here, and especially on farm products, I rose too much, and it wasn't only the taxes but the labor. Every man you bring in from the inside, outside, well, he'd only be with you a month and he'd see the construction wages and the way it'd go.
That's what killed the miner too.
Yeah.
You never got the mining
I had the mining bug. I'm just surprised. In 1910, there's a man by the name of Wooden. He had owned some ground out here on Steamboat Pup. You know where that is on Pedro?
Yes.
All right. There was a little fellow by the name of Eddie Wooding, and he was an old timer from the Circle Country. He went through here before Pedro did. Because he told me that he flipped coins over here on Hister Creek, whether they stay there or go on down to Manly Hot Springs. And he lost, and they went on down there. That was before Pedro's time.
Let's get his name again.
Eddie Austin.
Eddie Austin was before Pedro.
Yeah, he came in the country about 94, he told me. So, this Wooden, Eddie Austin was out there with him, so I knew Eddie pretty well, and so he come and got me in. We went out there and started sinking a hole in the Steamboat Pump. Mm-hmm. It was only about 18 feet to bedrock, and there's pretty good pay there. It was only about a 3-foot face. So we only went about 10 feet and we hit water. And the water sure did come in as we could get up the ladder. And so there's a fellow by the name of, or they called him Crazy Baker. He owned Four Below. And so it was a pretty good steep there, you know. So we thought we'd put a bedrock drain into this, but he wouldn't give it to us. And yet the bugger needed the water for his own sluicing.
He would get it that way.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't give it to
us. No. And so this Eddie Austin, he says, I was over there in Birch Creek, and he says, if we take a hike over to the greater unknown country. That is down the Horseshoe of Bend, Birch and Home. There's two creeks over there, Little Bear and Big Bear. And he says, there's a good porphyry that goes through there, and he says, there ought to be something there. So we each had a dog, and we put a pack on our back, and we started up. So we got over to Birch Creek, and I don't know what in the heck happened, but they fell. The creek was too high there, and they had to fall the trees, and I don't know if they got in an argument of some kind. So they wasn't talking. So we had to go up this Butte Creek and follow the ridge and go on over into this Bear Creek. And when we got over to Bear Creek, well, of course, he talked to me and everything, but he wouldn't show us nothing. So across the creek, there was an old timer who had come up from them. I don't know any of you people remember him now. His name was Bob Warren. They called him Stuttering Bob. His brother was a marshal down there. No. So him and his wife was over on the other side of Birch. And they were mining there, shoveling in. Of course, they'd have to add a dam there. And I really got enough water. That it comes through the sluice boxes. So we ran out of grub, so we went over and seen Bob and asked him if we could get enough grub to get Fairbanks. Well, he thought it over, and you know how he stuttered. It took him about half an hour to answer us. So he says that if you stay here and shovel in for a few days, well, I'll give you enough grub. Well, we shoveled in there for 5 days. Well, he could give us enough beans and a piece of a slab of bacon and some flour and some bacon powder, and that was it. And so we hit out. So we got about 6 miles of Fairbanks Creek, and we was out of food again. So I told Wooden and Austin, I says, I'm going to get up about 4 o'clock in the morning and hit for Fairbanks Creek, because I had a gun. could shoot some birds, you know. And it was about 60 miles into Fairbanks Creek. And I got up that morning early and I hit out. I kept going and I got into Fairbanks Creek about 8 o'clock that night. So I stopped at the roadhouse and gee, they had a wonderful meal. I guess it was because I was hungry. So it was only a little ways from Fairbanks Creek over until the steamboat pumped and the cabin was there and this man wouldn't have found me. So after this big meal, I felt pretty good and so I said, I thought I'll hike on over to the cabin. And of course, I'd left the other fellows. And so going up Fairbanks Creek, I was going fine, but I seen a nice spring there and I took a drink of water. And I cooked the goose. Had cramps and everything else. So the next morning I made it into the cabin. But believe me, she sure was a tough one. Mm. And then after I got back to Fairbanks Creek, then they come in there and we divided up and went our each direction and so come in to Fairbanks. And so then E.R. Peoples Johnson was running a store there where the Nordale is now. So Stroker, my brother-in-law, his bookkeeper for Peoples then. So there's a logger, wood chopper come up from Kuskokwim, was an old friend of his. So they wanted a road put through to the Chena Hot Springs. Well, Charlie Beam was running the hot springs that winter. So he took up a collection here in Fairbanks, so there was this McLean and myself and old Dilly. He was a teamster and we had a cook, I forget his name. So we started out from here. You can see the old marks over here where we cut a trail.
I followed it.
You have? We cut a trail from there for a four-horse team into the Chena Hot Springs.
Would you give us the year you did that?
1910.
Uh-huh.
Go on. Gosh, I'll never forget one night when we was up there above Jenny and Prick. And we had to go in there and pitch our tents and everything, and it was 52 below. Went out and cut spruce boughs.
What's the coldest you've seen here in your years?
68.
Mm-hmm. Where?
Right here in Fairbanks.
Right here in Fairbanks.
When?
What year?
That was in 34.
34.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know them days we didn't have this priest home and all this stuff.
I'll say no.
When I was running a little Chevrolet milk truck.
When'd you get your first truck, gas truck?
First gas truck, little Hinckley. When I took him over, he had a little Ford. First Ford truck I ever owned was 1912. Yeah.
What is the Chalmers?
Bobby Sheldon, if he's here tonight, he'd know because he worked with this man I bought it from. His name was Burgess. They worked on the Valdez Trail here together.
this is the Chalmers you have that you drive in the parade?
No. It had been a doctor in here. His name was Castle. And so he left here in 1908 and he went back to Seattle to practice. And while he was out there, he bought this 1908 Chalmers. And then in 1912, he came back in here to practice again. And he brought this Chalmers with him. Well, then he left here in a later year and he gave it to my uncle, Fred Noyes. So he had it for quite a few years. So when he left here, he gave it to my father. Well, my father never drove a car, and I just sat there. So if it wasn't running or nothing, it was just sitting there. So there was a couple of hard rock miners came in, and they were over on Esther Creek. So they asked my dad if he let them have it, they'd fix it up. So they put the electric starter and everything on it.
Oh.
Yeah, they were mechanics too.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, of course, after my dad passed away, then he turned it over to me. Mm-hmm.
1908.
Yeah.
And it's still running, for any of you that don't know or haven't seen it. And now I understand you've given it to the Centennial?
Yeah, they want it this summer. Mm-hmm. I hope they take care of it.
Sure will. We'll see to that.
I hope they. Because anything on there, they'll rob it, you know.
I
had a nice big brass horn. Oh, the rubber glove was about 14 inches long, and the brass horn was about 16 inches long, and somebody got away with that.
Mm.
And of course, they used to have the old carbide lights.
Yeah.
They got away with them. So, I hope they take care of it.
We might be able to find something put back on it.
Yeah.
Without lit the old carbide lights.
Well, we had quite a time. But she still runs good. Yeah, if I ever get enough money out of the country, I'm going to drive out there. Take it back to Michigan.
They'll give you a new one for it, I bet.
Hey, you know, in 1909, Barney Oldfield won his first race with one of these.
With one of these?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know?
His first win.
You were building the road up to Chino Hot Springs, and we left you at Ginny Am Creek. How long did it take you to get up to the springs?
Well, we started out from here, and in 3 weeks, we was in the Chino Hot Springs.
3 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
And they followed that trail ever since?
Yeah, lots of the folks told me. They followed. I've never been over it since.
You've never been over it since?
No.
You never stopped at Colorado Roadhouse?
No, not... Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, in the early days, I don't know whether you remember Tom Gibson or not.
I've heard of him.
Well, he had boats, and he had one he called the Gibson Girls, which really was a nice boat. And then he had this other little boat they called the Papoose. Well, so Charlie Beam wanted some feed for his horses, so we started up the Chena here with this Gibson girl and this little Papoose. So we could only get to the upper bluffs. The water was too much and the Gibson girl wouldn't go over it. So we had quite a few people with this, like Polly family and different ones, you know. So we left them with the upper bluffs, and so Tom and a little kid by the name of Roston. And myself, why we started up with the Papoose with the feed for the hot springs. Well, we kept it going and going, and finally got so goddamn tough that we had to get out on the banks with Tom with the rope around his neck and me with the rope around my neck, and the kid steering the boat. And we went as far as we could, and we got so couldn't we make a foot. So we got in 14 miles of Chena Hot Springs. So I sure surprised, because when we turned around to come down that North Fork, you know, it's just like coming off of a mountain going down that river.
You didn't know till then you'd been going uphill.
But in the early days here, I don't know, you heard of the Polly families. One of the sisters was married to Mr. Gordon, Margaret. And this Al Polly and I, before we had these pickers and everything, we used to take a pike pole, and we used to make about 10 miles a day and go to the upper bluffs.
Oh.
Of course, them days, the season was open on game.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd take a live box along, and when we got to the upper bluff, we'd turn around and float back and fill up our live box with grayling. And in July, you wouldn't believe it, we had 3 liters flies on the leaders, and we'd bring them out 3 at a time and throw them in the live box. And when we got the live box, then of course you couldn't come too fast, you had a fluke with the stream. And then when we got down to Potlatch Slough, we'd wait there, and it never took us over 3 hours until we could kill a moose. But we'd shoot him right on the beach, you know. Of course, in days, when a model cafe gave us 25 cents a pound for the moose, and we get 50 pounds for the cents a pound for the grayling.
Who ran the model cafe?
For them days, in the early days when it first started, I think it was Capel and Finn.
apron and thin.
Yeah, that was way back in 1905 and 6 and 4. And then after Cape and Finn, then at the big fire come, and then they moved down to where they were, you know, now. And Tom Yule and Berglund and somebody else was in there.
Tom Yule was there when I came to the country.
He was, huh?
Did you ever hear of a Vashon?
Peter?
Peter Vashon, did you know
three
them?
Three brothers.
The what?
Three brothers.
Three brothers? Tell us about them.
Daughter.
No, be quiet. That's his daughter sitting down there.
Yeah, that's what I found out. Yeah, one of the brothers was at Tannenhall, and another one was at Tullamanna, and Peter, he was here, Vashon and Sterling, and they had a store down there on First and Noble.
There was a picture in the paper the other day about 50 below in Fairbanks and no ice fog.
Yeah.
And one of the top of one of the buildings in that picture had Vashon's store on it.
Vashon.
She got all excited.
Is that right? Well, you know, here in the early days, we had all the smoke of gold. Mm-hmm. And of course, the NC stack was high, and over here where Gordon had, they had a power plant there too, they had a high stack. But all these cabins coming out, they had high stacks because they had to have the draft to pull it through. But well, we didn't have the smoke or anything then.
And you think it's the gasoline from the cars that's doing it now?
The gasoline, there's quite a bit of it, but you take your city power plant and your FE power plant causes lots of it. Because you take out there at our place, why, it's always clear. But you go along noisy slew, you see, from the water from the hot turbine.
Yeah, it's warm.
Yeah, when it gets so cold, then the fog raises.
Steaming.
Mm-hmm. But I think when they, next year, when they shut down the plant here, I think on that side of the river, they'll be all rid of ice fog.
I got two questions and we'll finish for tonight.
Yeah.
The Little Loki burnt wood going from Fairbanks to Chattanooga. Did they carry enough wood for the entire trip, or did they have to stop and wood up like the riverboats did?
Yeah, another thing is we used to start out here and going up Gold Stream, we'd stop and take on water and wood. And then when we got to the Gillimore, we'd stop there again and fill up with water and wood. That was the bend where we had to turn around and go fox and mm-hmm. come over into Dome. And we fill our pump full of water. This is this whole engine, 51 and 52. And have her blowing off full head of steam. But by the time we got up to the saddle and tipped over, there's no water. And so we'd have to wait there and steam up again.
Was 51 and 52 bigger than old number one?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One and two, there were only two of those drives for
the
mm-hmm.
The others were
51,
four.
Yeah.
They had their own water tender with them.
Yeah, they had their own water tender. But this little number one.
What did he do?
Hmm?
He carried wood on a flat car behind him, or did he have a tender?
Or on this
number one.
No, they had a tender behind. But it only had a little water jacket. And every time he just got to go good and run out of water, and then he'd have to stop somewhere along and fill it up with water again.
The only water it carried was this jacket
that
draped over the boiler.
Yeah, it was over the boiler.
You may not know, but we just sent that down to Anchorage, and the railroad shops renovated it and fixed it all up, and it's now down on the park.
Is that right?
It looks real nice.
I have to go up someday and look at it because I farted it, you know.
Boy, I'm taking you down. Get a picture of you sitting in it. Well, that's very fine, Charlie. It's 10 o'clock, and we'll close off this meeting for now.
Yeah.
And because I didn't get a chance to introduce on the tape in the beginning, this is a talk by Charlie Kramer at the Chamber of Commerce Building Thursday, January the 26th, 1967, for the Tanana-Yukon Historical Society. And before we close, Charlie, I would like your father and mother's name And I would like the number of brothers and sisters and their names.
Boy.
Is that too hard?
My dad was Charles N. Kramer.
Charles N.?
Kramer.
Kramer.
And my mother's name was Martha, what was it? You got me.
Martha?
Yeah, Kramer.
Do you know where they were married?
They were married in Weaverville, California.
Weaverville. That's in the pretty country.
Yeah, that was a mining town, too.
How many brothers and sisters did you have?
Well, I was pretty lucky. I had 6 sisters and myself.
No brother to fight with? Could you give us their names?
My older sister was Tessie, and the next one was Maddie, and the next one was Frances, and then I come along, and then the next sister was, she died. Let me see, there's Genevieve. Next sister next to me, of course I was small, and then she died. And then there was Genevieve and Marion.
Thank you, Charlie Kramer, very much. This is Lieutenant of Yukon Historical Society, second interview with Charles Kramer. His first talk was on January the 26th, and he is now talking again in the Chamber of Commerce building in Fairbanks, Alaska on May the 25th, 1967. Charlie, we welcome you here again. Talk before was so very, very interesting that we want to hear you tonight. You suggested yourself, and we would like to get it all on tape, your steamboat knowledge, information, the boats you've contacted, worked on, rode on, and then drift off into the Chattanooga Railroad. So take it from here. What's your first good story on steamboating?
All I can say, I'll do it just from memories. I ain't got no books or anything. But before we go into the Tanana Valley Railroad, in the early days, when the boats used to come up the town and all, they were heavy laden with barges. And so they'd stop at Chena. And if the river was high enough, like it is just like now today, they come on up the Chena River. And if the river was low, they'd have to stop at Chena. And they had to have extra barges. And they'd have to lighten the freight. And there were 2 companies here them days, like this used to be the Alaska Commercial, and the NAT&T Company was the Northern Alaska Transportation and Trading Company.
What does NAT&T mean for strangers?
North American Transportation and Trading Company. And they had 3 boats running. They had the Cudahy and the Weir, and this bar, what's named below to Fairbanks here, what they call the Leo Bar. They had 3 boats, and then I think the NC Company, or the Alaska Commercial, had the Swatka and the Tanana. What was the other boat? There's one other boat. They had 3 boats. And so, there was so much trouble with the water that and lighten these barges and everything, and it cost quite a bit of money. So the NAT&T Company, they located the Chena. And when you come down to it and go back into memories, Chena should have been the town. Because when Barnett come up here, there was a nice bunch of timber across the river, which Fairbanks now. And they could get lots of logs for the cabins and everything, so he located here. But Chena was a little bit farther from the mines. But when you figure it out in the early days, when it was nothing but horse bar, that they could have come right up the valley here and dropped over into Gold Stream and went up. But no, they freighted the freight from Chena, but they couldn't land it in Fairbanks. And the first road from Fairbanks went up through the graveyard, and what we call the Ridge Road. and it'd come into Gilmore Creek. Well, that was a tough road for horses and everything to carry the freight. And but now I see they changed that road name to what they call the Gilmore Trail. Then I know in the first winter, by Darning Gardner, they had about 24 head of horses and mules, and there was so much freight that couldn't get landed up here that they were running four horse teams up to here, and then they go on to the creeks with them. So then I don't know where this man, his name was Joslin, and I don't know where he come from. I never have nothing on him. But he come in here and started a railroad from Chena to Fairbanks. And this little one engine what they got up here, I think it's a Centennial, that's a little engine he brought in here. And in them days, he just cut the trees down and he laid his ties down and put the rails on top of them, right on top of the moss and the peat bed, you know. And of course, when you come up from Chena, the old track was kind of wavy because they had no ballast. So then, after you put the road into Fairbanks, well then, he seen that these creeks were all opening up. You take like you go out on Goldstream, Engineer, Gilmore and Pedro. It ain't only the creek drains, but it's the first tier and the second tier and so forth on each side. And he's seen the great possibilities for a railroad. So he started out and he went out through Happy and he went right up through Goldstream as far as Gilmore. And they made a loop there and they turned around and they went up Fox. And what they went up on top of the hill was Ridgetop. And when they hit Ridgetop, then they dropped over the divide and they could follow on down. There was, well, then days, there was Dome and there's El Dorado and there's Vault and there's Treasure and Chattanooga. And they went that far. And the railroad was kept busy because you take every mine was 20 acres and maybe there was three or four laymen on every mine. And the railroad was kept busy all summer long.
But wasn't it true, Charlie? What was the name of this little Loki when it ran from Chena to Fairbanks?
Oh, just number one. That's all we ever called her.
But isn't it a misnomer to call it Alaska Railroad number one?
No, it wasn't.
Didn't it die out on its existence before the Alaska Railroad was built?
Well, when the Alaska Railroad took over, well, then they had number one, and they had number two, and they had number four, and 51 and 52.
But was this little number one capable of going over to Chattanooga?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then they got bigger locomotives in. It wasn't much more bigger than the one. I don't know how they were coming. There was two and four. They were two-wheel drives, you see. They used them, and then they come along to the 51 and 52, and they were three-wheel drives. And so when they started building the railroad, well, after I come back out of the Army, I went to work for them. I was on a steam shovel, and I put in a little... Pete Anderson and myself, we was on the steam shovel, and we had one of them big marine shovels, you know, but it took two men to run. And we put in all the cuts between here and Nenana. And then they were shorter ballasts on the Chattanooga run, so we took the steam shovel up to on Fox, and we started digging out ballasts. I think that was 1919, and that was the year the flu broke out. And I think we had about 51 men out there, and we cut down to three of us. all the rest come in with the flu, so then the train crew went off. They all had the flu. So Deacon Jones and a fellow by the name of Van Bandman and myself and this gunner Pearson, he worked here for the FE company for years. We took the train running from Fairbanks over to Chattanooga. They had no crew left. And there was another man worked with us. His name was George Blondew.
What year would you say he built this railroad from Chena to Fairbanks? In other words, it was in operation quite a while before they started the road down to Nenana.
Oh, 1905 and 1906.
Yeah. And this Loki came in on a riverboat from St. Michael.
Yeah.
And all the steel came that way.
All the steel, yeah.